Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Glories of Valletta's Royal Opera House. This talk is delivered by Mr. Salvatore Musu.
So, yes, opera. Actually, it's the Royal Opera House. And in fact, I am going to also talk about the subject, because the subject we observe is the glories of Valletta's Royal Opera House. Rather, it's seven words, but each word has got its meaning and its importance, why I mentioned this lengthy title to today's lecture. Well, first of all, I started that my love for opera was imbued me with my mother. She used to live at the corner, exactly, Francia building, you know, a beautiful building by Bonavia, and there was a building today, of course, it all dropped down. But she was at the corner, there were five stories, and she used to look, and she was still young, and until she got married, through the window to observe what happened even before, because one has to also think that opera is not just opera. Opera house, and the opera house, this is an important thing. If we want to create something for the building as an opera house, which is different, we are going to kill more Valletta, because opera in itself, and I don't mean opera even other thing, but the most important opera itself, was a crowd puller. Even a machine for other organizations, and it was also a big employer as well, because many people were so interested to be employed with the opera house that they came to live. There was an increase in population in Valletta and Floriana. In fact, there are even legends about the burning of the Royal Opera House. Well, she imbued because she used to tell me what happened. And I don't know if I am seeing here Marquis Nicolas de Pira. Is he here? I think he must be here. And once I interviewed him on the radio, and he used to tell me, give you just an inkling, before the opera, because there was prior to the opera itself, and of course the intervals. And even the aftermath. These were all celebrations. You can't imagine what a sort of life it was, how important, not just opera itself, I repeat it. Not sure. But, and I remember when we were talking, he told me that he did observe, you know, Francia buildings, no? And there was Lady Francia. She used to go and all help paraphernalia at that moment, you know, leaving the door and going to the opera. Now, please, what's the distance there? 10, 20 meters, the utmost? And I still remember his remark on the radio, and he told me, yes, that's better. He told me that, you know, a whole crowd used to come to see, you know, you can imagine the sailors, soldiers with their swashbuckling swords and whatnot, and the paraphernalia, especially on Thursday evenings. And he told me that Lady Francia, when she came out, there was a hush crowd. Come, Lady Francia is coming out, and everybody, especially the ladies, to see her. And she took from the front of Francia door to the door of the opera house, so small, she used to take 20 minutes. Why? Because one of the perhaps, of course, it's an exaggeration, but that shows also the great importance that not only the opera itself, but the addenda, I would say, other things that also were a crowd, a puller, a magnet for all these, as we shall see later on, how many other interesting things did happen. So, please, as you know, I already started on the wrong foot, because I always start my lectures, please, I have to write my lectures because I have that terrible habit of going off at tangents. I always say that my favorite author was Gilbert K. Chesterton, who was great, but he always went absolutely out of tune with his subject. But of course, I am not like him, but he is a wonderful writer. Anyway, so I'd better read it to be sure that I keep on the track of my thoughts. So I sit down. I do hope that you hear me, or otherwise, no, I don't. I prefer to stand up to have more feeling, which, after all, opera is a feeling. Well, Albert Einstein, oh my goodness, I started. the great scientist once said, please keep it in mind, this for you as well, before you go to sleep, he who does not dream is a half-dead person. Coming from such a man, this is indeed a big surprise. So, to prove that we are all full and squarely kicking, let us this evening dream for about an hour or so. And this place, now this is another thing, it makes you more feeling like you feel like crying than like feeling so happy about what happened long ago. Because this vergogna that we see here of the remains of the opera house is really something heartbreaking. Many ask me, what is it? Many, even all, yeah, they told me, are these Roman remains? Well, and this place, so close to the shattered, pitiful remains of our once glorious theater, could not be bettered to resuscitate, if possible, some hazy dreams that our parents must have witnessed and lived through up to, say, 7 decades ago. Whether the pilot of the Luftwaffe had aimed at our opera house willingly and purposefully, nobody can prove it, and neither, I think, can it be ascertained in the future. Probably he is dead. What we can ascertain, however, because we are living witnesses, is that the rest of our temple of culture was callously demolished, I was going to say, with a vengeance, by the Maltese authorities of the horrible 50s. So, when we say that the Germans destroyed one-fourth of our theater, we, to prove that we are more civilized than the Teutonic ogre, we willingly and with gusto destroyed the remaining three-fourths of our Teatro Real. But let's not start at the tail end of our talk and go straight to the beginning, or better still, at the title of our talk, The Glories of Valletta's Royal Opera House. Perhaps for some, the word glories may appear a too pompous one, full of nostalgic exaggerations. But, as we shall soon see, or rather hear, glorious indeed were the times, the happenings, the presentations, and the story of the theatre itself. And, to top it all, the crowning glory was the building itself, inwardly and perhaps more outwardly, but of this later on. When I was planning this series of lectures on rediscovering Valletta, I insisted on inserting the name of our capital city, not only to concur with the main theme of these talks, but also because I wanted to stress its important connection with this theatre, and vice versa. That is, the theatre in connection with our capital city. This unbreakable link had led and developed a social activity that forged a deeper sense of respect, devotion, appreciation, and love for the city more than ever before, and perhaps more than anything else, apart from the religious aspect, of course. What I mean to say here is that, contrary to what is happening today when Valletta becomes an addolorata cemetery after 7 o'clock of every evening, the opera house was a magnet that supplied that extra elixir of life and activity, day in, day out, just at the entrance of Valletta, that augured and provided a boost for the rest of the city. Next comes the glories of Valletta's Royal Opera House. Well, now the third word, because I said the glories, Valletta and Royal. Now, this is another point which I have to explain and understand what the Maltese meant by mentioning the word royal. The word royal, this will not go down perhaps statefully for some, if not many, for the simple reason that, as a famous English poet once said, scepter and crown must tumble down. Whilst for others, once we are a republic, there is no place for monarchical appellatives. But please bear with me, because this is a point that has to be discussed aptly in as short time as possible, to be understood and appreciated in our idiom and way of thinking that clarifies and justifies my other insistence to include the word royal. Now, let me go straight to the point of my beliefs and principles. Please excuse me, I am a Republican at heart, So, no love is lost in ignoring monarchical institutions and appellatives. So my sticking to the word royal has other motives that refer to interpretations, cultural and historical implications, which are the following. Our forefathers, it's important, used to call their main town or village street Estrada Reale, Royal Street in English. Today it's Main Street or El Gbira, which might mean huge or enormous, and many times huge and that means monstrous as well. But Royal Strada Reale, this was never meant to refer to any royalty. But because it was, and in several cases still is, there are many who still mentioned, for example, High Street, Hamruna Reale, even in our villages. And Strada Reale, we still say it's Strada Reale. As I said, it does not mean to royalty, but because, and in several cases, still is the most prominent, albeit important, road through which, now here is the point, used to pass the King of Kings in the majority of religious processions. So now you can understand how inconsiderate was a past street naming committee when it renamed our Strada Reale as Republic Street. A step that showed lack of respect for the cultural intentions and mentality of our forefathers. Documents of the Knights period clearly show that even though they had named the main street of Valletta Estrada San Giorgio, the people already used to know it, and it's mentioned also in documents, by the name of Strada Reale, even in the time of the Knights, much before the coming of the British. Which brings us to today's Royal Opera House. It is quite obvious that this, yet Sir Adriano Dingley and his Bella Compagnia labeled our theatre as the Royal Opera House. They had only the British monarchy in mind, obvious. But when the Maltese started calling it, and many still do, as it Teatro Real, the Royal Theatre, perhaps instinctively, they had in mind an acknowledgement of the supreme prominence and importance of this magnificent building under all aspects. Not, of course, the religious one, I mean, but, and this is a big but, when religious, this is important, when religious, semi-religious, or even religious personage was even just mentioned, people could not refrain from showing their deep attachment to their religious convictions. So there was this mix-up as well, with convictions with religion, real royalty and the religious beliefs of the devotions of the Maltese. So, there you are. And after royal comes opera. Although that infinitesimal minority who want to make us forget Barry's monumental achievement still throw fuel to the controversial fire that opera is not fashionable, or it is an elitist production, the fact still remains that its greatest achievements and fame rest mainly on opera, as we shall soon see. Opera, as a well-known American writer said, is the best way to teach people. Opera in our Royal Opera House was more often than not superb, supreme, and the most important social activity of our country. But this never meant that the theatre was solely for opera productions. Eh? In fact, we see even, in charge of the Historical Society, many times we see that great cultural persons and literary men and poets used to go and do beautiful poetic serate, poetic evenings in the theatre, which used to be also packed up with people, even famous Italian and English poets. Many and varied were other activities in the cultural field, which brings us to the word house. Now, this is interesting as well, but this is now, the etymologically speaking, the English way that dating of house. This house is a purely English expression, of course, for a theatre. It's strange, nobody calls opera a house in all other languages. But this is interesting, I found out. This expression for a theatre that reflects an ancient Anglo-Saxon ideas of a theater. So there's this house. Why is it house of a theater? What the English, again, not only contextual, but etymological meaning. Well, it may be interpreted in other ways, such as a covered spot derived the Germanic original Teutonic word is house, but H-A-U-S, as you know. House, English. However, this word itself was derived from the Sanskrit language, very language, which meant simply an upturned basket. Why? What? How does this come into the picture? And house in English and house in German. And now, the word in Sanskrit was hosha. The Teutonic came hosha, it came house, and English came from house, German came from. Where is it upturned basket? Which simply meant a covered spot. So the idea of the English, etymologically speaking, of a word, or for the opera house, they only use the word house. It comes from so many ancient ideas that it's an upturned basket, which, as you know, it's like these concert halls, the opera house, and so on. They are indeed like an upturned basket. This is a bit lengthy introduction, simply for the title, however, may make some of you edgy, if not angry. So, as Pagliacci says, vesti la giubba, on with the motley. The finest visual glory of our Royal Opera House was without doubt its architecture, in my view. It's useless to harp on the now nauseating reasons that are brought about by those few, very few, but influential, mysteriously influential detractors of Barry's design, due to his non-alignment with Strada Reale, with Kingsway. The so-called mistake of an unknown gradient, and that Barry never came to Malta. These are all fallacies. These flimsy excuses today, I am not going to enter into an ever-ending conflict, but I cannot let go the lie that Barry never came to Malta. In fact, he came twice personally to Malta to see that no more mistakes are done. In fact, he had even had a big row with his draftsman who made mistakes. It was the draftsman who made mistakes, and Barry simply sent him off. And it was a most appropriate and welcoming gesture on his part, because with his side visit he managed to create a masterpiece that stopped all critics and managed to create a rare occurrence in Malta. It is really rare, it had to be the Royal Opera House. When the opera house was finished, the whole Maltese and Gozitan people, they were unanimous in their acclaim from all Maltese as well as foreigners that visited our islands. Our opera house was simply a European masterpiece. It's not the time here, and we do not have enough time either, to enter into its architectural details. But some points have to be mentioned here that demonstrate how well and truly this building deserves to be called glorious. A true architect shows his geniality when he is involved in some project that presents difficulties that at first might even appear unsurmountable. And this is a case in point where Barry should be lauded and not detracted. The criticism, if we may call it so, that even up to this day is leveled at the architect is that he made a mistake. Brackets sick, in planning originally a theater on a perfectly smooth and level ground. As if any architect, unless you tell him so and give him the correct specifications, is going to do otherwise. He was not informed, Barry, that there was the slope, so it's not his mistake. What information was sent? Barry was not informed of this terrain situation, but when he got to know it, he rearranged his plan. Another defect, so-called, was that he did not keep on to the street alignment. Quite so, but his first plan did respect, in a way, such a local situation. What happened was that when he was informed of the split level, of course he had to correct it, which he did. But this was indeed, I might call it, a blessing in disguise, because he rearranged the front and designed a beautiful portico, leaving the ground floor close to the alignment. So the portico is close, as you can see, to the alignment. Then he moved it southward. And to complement it, there's the Francia building, which also moved a bit inward. On a tangential little explanation, when Francia wanted Bonavia to make the magnificent building, they told him, listen, it must compete with the opera house. So that's why he built it, that in this pseudo-Venetian neoclassic style. Now, all those detractors of the opera house, imagine if we were to pull down that, because it simply does not show the trend of our times, and it does not agree with Valletta. What would happen to that beautiful one? You see it with flowers, and now it's something really almost out of this world. And when he created, close to the alignment, and he created a podium that was, in my view, a brilliant solution to the frontage. Not only, but to show his respect to the mother of opera houses and to the Maltese, perhaps few of you observed this, whose direct contract for millennia with Italy made them quite familiar with Milan's La Scala, he reproduced this podium, the facade's facade, in the Tank Heaven's still existent ground floor arcade. So he made, which means the podium that is still there, it's an exact copy of the front of La Scala, Opera House of Milan. Go observe it next time, go and see it. Have a photo of Milan, and you see that he reproduced it exactly, only the podium, mine. Thank heavens, this is still in existence, so that anybody can appreciate it. Another criticism, again, still whispered today, is that its architecture does not match with that of Valletta. Such, I dare say, in my view, a hypocritical statement is usually leveled by critics who, to top it all, are in favor of erecting a building with today's idiom. Does this mean that Valletta has to suffer still further architectural degradations, like those of St. Albert the Great monstrosity, headquarters of the General Curse Union, the ex-Manderaggio, the lower Barracca, the embassy complex, and I had better stop. Michelangelo once said, this is also a very interesting statement, anche nell'anticlassicismo c'è sempre il classicismo. Now, what does this mean? Even in anticlassicism, there is classicism. But this was stated at a time when mannerism was born, that paved the way for the Baroque, etc. And this expression, perhaps without knowing, was kept alive even by our builders, Capomastri and architects, up to the eve of the monstrous 50s. What I mean by this expression is that even though perhaps there were these movements and whatnot, the Maltese builders, the Maltese Capomastri, and even architects up to the 50s, they still had that great discipline of the classical world that forced them to, you know, not to go berserk and create something like I used to be at the MEPA. Authorities, some young architects used to do, our idea is to shock. Architecture is not to shock. Architecture is to create something beautiful, interesting, and if possible, ethereal. So, turning to our vandalized opera house, the building, which more than anything else was an exponent of neoclassicism, a style. Now, this is important. A style that at the time was rampant in the north and quite popular in the south of Europe. In short, it was the style of an epoch. Furthermore, one has to bear in mind that the 19th century, the golden age of opera, gave birth to a general building spree of opera houses that, in their entirety, followed this architectural trend, style and type. So for those who insist on a building that should mirror the times, they should bear in mind also that our opera house was a statement of the times pursued by all Europe, and when it came to the aftermath of World War II, All were rebuilt except in one instance in Germany, which became a terrible slum where all sorts of criminals used to step in. All the others was a disaster under every aspect. Despite exactly all of them were built as they were before the war. In fact, Dresden Opera House was almost completely gutted by the Allies in the 1942. Don't say Hitler, but the German authorities, let's say, at the time. They ordered immediate rebuilding during the war, because the people had to at least forget what was happening, and they said it was not just hope, it was the theater. They had to go to the... It was rebuilt. So, con gusto, con arte, an expression in Italian which means with real relish, when the Allies saw that it was rebuilt, they sent a carpet bombing, and with the theater went 3/4 of the city. But when they saw the rebuilding, that it was, well, it's impossible, within a few months it was rebuilt again exactly as it was. So, to be sure, they trashed it all down together with all surrounding areas. Not knowing what they had in mind. Well, many times, if not always, a headache for an architect who is asked to plan an isolated building. Now, this is another point, and this point was pointed to me by, poor, we say a prayer for him, by my friend, Perit architect Joseph Spiteri, who is very ill, and a chap, then in any case, such a nice man, such a great interpreter and teacher of architecture as it should be. In the last exhibition that he made, sorry now to be a bit blunt, and he made an exhibition who was already, because Parkinson's disease has started. He said, if I were to go to the university, I would insist that the first year of the architecture students would be simply to learn how to hold a pencil. Now, in our, or rather Berry's instance, this was indeed another architectural glory. Because, why? Because of the four corners of the theater were a brilliant solution and execution. The way the four corners were projected, that Bert were a bit forward through the four Corinthian palaces, was indeed, I might call it, a stroke of genius. Without knowing it, Berry had indeed, perhaps more than anybody else, followed the map of the knights, instructions that each and every corner of the city had to be beautified and beautiful. Now here you see the great architectural, not adventure, but the great architectural result that he made it. There are the corners here. You see them jutting out, and the four edges. This was indeed a stroke of genius. Very few observe it. When recently there were other some competition they made, no architect, even the famous, wonderful, world-renowned, they simply did not care less about the corners. But this was a brilliant solution. This is the greatest, in my view, and of Joe Spiteri as well, the greatest beautiful architectural solution when the corners were so brilliantly built. This is the building as it was before it was burned down. This later after it was burned down. There are some difficulties. What I would like to point out here to show you this page is that he designed beautiful, wonderful sculptures of statues which were never put up. But these here, there were sculptures, and in spite of my great interest, it seems that it's impossible that they all were destroyed, but who knows where they are hidden today. In any case, a quick glance at the interior, of course, now this is only a quick glance, but otherwise I would do a treatise on architecture. At the interior, of course, through extant plans, one can observe another glory that is with the perfect arrangement and systemization of the available site and space as regards the three principal objectives of those times, but which are also relevant today. These three all equally important points were to lead Berry towards a solution in planning that is even aesthetically pleasant to look at, even on a plan, and admire it. In fact, he divided the interior into exactly three distinct, perfectly equal parts. You know? And you have, of course, these three parts are, you have, of course, the all-important stage, for the spectacle, not through what they say, so there's a very small space, to exactly one-third of the whole area. You have the equally important auditorium, where the people used to stay, and for the times, the also equally important mundane area. It was the foyer. On mentioning, now this is another point, please keep it in mind. I think today, in spite of what is done, classist and race for certain people and what not, that's absolutely not true. May I tell you, remind you, that the upper tiers of the theater were for those people who could not afford money. The opera at the time, for all these, and they were the best critics, mind you, they were the best critics, these. Mind you, if you managed to do something wrong, because they used to immediately spot you and your career is finished. It was only sixpence a seat. Sixpence. By today's son, my father used to say, when he was there, he said that he's got, the good pay has got 2 shillings a daily. So I made the calculations. Sixpence a seat, by today's money, meant it was about £4 for an opera. Today they charge you 40 and more. And they say that at that time it was a classic for the riches. Not true. In fact, there were the abbonati, there were those who were members, and they did not go always for the opera. Many times they went for one, and then, listen, some operas were repeated 20 times in the same season. They repeated just the same. So they went the first time. Then all those, especially many, were industrialists. They used to distribute it among because they paid just the same, or their employees. The employees used to benefit from that. Not one, two, or three, because all of them, they simply made them and they went to see in their stead. So, we are mentioning the foyer. On mentioning the foyer, many instantly fall into the trap of believing modern denigrators of opera house who decried the classy separation of the times. This is another also stroke of genius of Barry. Very few know about it. So there were separation. They used to say because there were the rich men, those of a high class and of low, they never met. No, this was done. They had other things in mind. This is not true, because the Royal Opera House catered for everybody's social standing. What these denigrators point at is that there were different and separate corridors that, according to them, did not let persons of the so-called lower class mingle with those of a higher social status. This is a fallacy, to say the least, because it's that there were separate and different corridors for the tiers, but this was another stroke of excellent and expert planning by Barry, who purposely planned them in this manner, so that in case of an emergency, such as fire, quite common in theatres and those types, and when it burned down, it proved its worth. Nobody got hurt, except just a little burning of these, until those days. So, no panic-stricken crowd would amass with the on just one door or two doors, with the consequent tragic consequences. But so that each and every tire would have different exits. I dare not enter into details of this interior. Time does not permit. I can only simply say, and this I leave it for your imagination, that the exterior was indeed a mirror of the interior. And now, about architecture, I'd better stop. There are many other things. I am not an architect. I wish I were an architect. But those were the times, different times. And I had better stop about the architectural glories, because other glories await this once famous National Temple of Culture. Glories, one might even call them material, that apart from their supplying our forefathers with decent, honest, and cultural enjoyment, they were a sort of educational advancement of the masses. As a remount, American music critic once said in her monumental work on Giuseppe Verdi. Let's keep one point in mind, and this will close the architectural aspect. This is a point, When the British, I mean not only the local colonial authorities, but also the excellence of the British ruling class of Victorian England, Now, let's keep one point in mind, and this will close the architecture aspect. When the British, I mean not only the local colonial authorities, but also the echelons of the British ruling class of Victorian England, when the British were asked to provide us with one of their foremost architectural champions, they gave us their best renowned architect, whose extant works are still today considered as most worthy of admiration. I still remember the words of my friend, architect Joseph Spiteri, who, saddened by the nihilist approach of an infinitesimal minority, but influential one at that, he had exclaimed, he told me this paragone, this reasoning, if somebody gives you a photograph of your father, do you ever think of tearing it up and even trample upon it? Of course not. But that's what we did when we destroyed the Opera House. The vicissitudes of the period that predates this building are known. No need to enter them, at least to some of you. There were a lot of squabbles, criticism and disagreements, but finally, after some 6 years of deliberations, not 70 years, like Alton, a decision was reached, and in this sense, our forebears are much superior to our way of dealing with such matters. 6 years have passed since its front collapse, and we are still discussing. In any case, the theatre was ready by 1866, and when the day of its completion and opening arrived, everybody, without exception, not only accepted this excitingly new architectural marvel, but all lavished praise, love, and later on became a source of pride for the whole Maltese nation. I have in mind here a short, very short, but delightful description of the way Maltese looked at our Royal Opera House on its completion, by Malta's foremost novelist, Giuse Gallia, in his perhaps most renowned work, Metanhara et Teatro. By the way, it seems, but I don't know the authorities about Metanhara et Teatro. I read it on local radio station and discussed it also. This matter, it was such a success that they repeated it 5 times, and they still say that the people don't want the opera house. But it roughly runs as follows, what Giuse Gallia said, very roughly. In Malta, there was a lot of commotion and excitement, especially in the cities. Everybody was talking about the wonderful operas that were being staged in the new theatre close to Porta Reale. The Royal Opera House had just been completed and came to be as one of the most beautiful buildings that adorned our capital city. The ornamental features, the craftsmanship, the impeccable style, the beauty of its carvings and sculptures, and the richness of its decorations fascinated all who beheld it. The Maltese felt a deep sense of wonder and pride every time that they looked at it, that honored their country and even caused a stare of jealousy in the heart of foreigners. As soon as the theatre opened its doors, it gave a new light to Valletta. This is Giuse Gallia, and infused another way of life. All Maltese had never witnessed and tasted the beauty and luxury of grand opera. Our Royal Opera House, for its beauty, brilliance and grandiose aspect, stood easily side by side with any other major theatre of Europe. No sooner was the theatre ready than it detached itself from all surrounding buildings, took on a haughty aspect and a cause of praise that deserved the immediate bestowal of a name of the highest order, the Royal Theatre. The Maltese people were not only lavish in their praises, but regarded it as one of their most cherished buildings. This is what Giuse Gallia said, which shows that definitely he went in there, he observed it, and he loved it. Of course, to describe it in this manner. Every person in Malta, especially if he happened to be of a certain standing or considered himself to be so, used to go to this opera house, whilst everyone who was an absolute non-entity also used to go there to make believe that he was indeed somebody. In clubs, in shops, in business gatherings, in halls, wherever 4 persons met, one used to hear them mentioning the Real Teatro and lauding the artists that performed there yet. Men, of course, preferred discussing the latest prima donna, and it was the time also, now it's men mentioning this novel, of Giuseppe, of Rosa Doré, who intoxicated the Maltese audience with her lovely singing. And of course, naturally, the description goes on and on describing the personal beauty and fascination of the bel canto of the soprano, Giuseppe Gallia continued. Of course, much of the ploy of Giuseppe Gallia in this novel is mere fantasy. But when he comes to the theater and the singers, Giuseppe Gallia demonstrates without any shadow of doubt that he was a first-hand witness of the glorious days of the opera house, as well as the glorious exposition of this magnificent building. Well, we were talking of its opening day, and what a glorious day it was, that of Tuesday, the 9th of October, 1866. The opera chosen was that of Vincenzo Bellini, I Puritani, and the choice was not, unlike what happens today, without a reason. It happened to be exactly the 30th anniversary of its first presentation. Now, a little daydreaming, or even evening dreaming, I would call it, to be exact. Imagine that wonderful night, the theater that provided a spectacular scene on the outside as well as on its inside, where the lights caused the audience to admire and gasp at the beautiful decorations that adorned the boxes and the whole auditorium. The theater, it couldn't be otherwise, was filled to capacity. And more, perhaps, it is recorded that tickets were being sold at exorbitant prices, even as high as 100 times the original price, through the black market, of course. And many remained outside, could not buy it. The success of this evening was so great that this opera, this, which is a Puritani, is a grand, truly grand opera. It's not just like opera of, let's say, Bohème or Pagliacci. This was so great that this opera, in this theater only, was repeating during one season 18 times over. The first season of the Valletta Royal Opera House lasted from 9th October up to 31st May of the following year. 7 months. But before concluding this baptism of our opera house, I would like to sidestep a bit and refer to a recent interview with a local. There was a table on Life magazine, may I show it to you, this here, Joseph Aquilina, on the magazine Life and Style of some days ago. Now, I'd like to, what's it, it's short. Now, on page 3 of the article, there's this is an interviewer. The cliché goes that opera caters for a very specific audience, is opera life and dwell in Malta, and how true is this statement? Joe Aquilina replied, yes, opera caters for a specific audience, unfortunately. Not true. In Malta, it is alive, but very limited. It's a contradictory in terms. The number of performances is mostly limited to 2 per title, with maybe 4 or 5 titles annually shared between the 3 major opera houses of Malta and Gozo. This is in 1 year, if we are lucky to have 5 operas. But now, please, compare about the same year we are talking. Compare to what occurred in our Royal Opera House in this only this one, mind you, during the first season, which means November, December, January, up to May. 167 operas, grand operas were presented, which means, if you make the days, almost 1 every day. If I were to relate all the successes, several of which were indeed glorious evenings, this talk would take several hours, and thinking of this first evening, the like of which were other evenings, of course, during the opening season of 1866-67. An inquisitive mind would instantly seek the organization element of such a huge undertaking. Another point, which is, might be the glory, another glory of the opera house, the organizational element. And here I would like to add another glory, that is that of the famous impresari, the organizers, which until this day are legend, at least for those who hold local opera history at heart. But this is a matter that may astonish us all. Nowadays, our country, in step with Europe, is overwhelming bureaucracy, is full of managers, directors, secretaries galore with their under-secretaries, committees, and this cannot be numbered. Sometimes I say there are more managers than watchmen. In any case, I hate to think what would the organization nowadays would be like if it had to take care of such a task as that of presenting and producing what I have mentioned, 116 grand operas just mentioned in one season alone. Bombastic in summer today for making one opera. Not mentioning also another glory, the famous scenery. I'm not mentioning today, but there were the greatest artists, Giuseppe Calì, Vincenzo Cremona. Sometimes, you don't believe them, these things. I think Mosconi, his surname was, they brought a painter from Italy. These scenes were so wonderful that the men never stopped clapping. The orchestra conductor was angry. They wanted to sing. No, they clapping for the beautiful scenery that this Italian painter made, just for the... And they forced him to come out, and they made curtain calls for the painter. Only. And today you just make a plane down because it's modern. Not so during the 19th century's production of operas at our beloved Royal Theatre. Another point. This was so important that the Impresa, when it had the contract, one of the conditions was that they were scrutinized and they had to be historians, those who organized it. Why? Because if they found that a costume did not fit of the medieval period or did not fit of the 18th or so, and they said, no, you have to change it, that's not good. Even this was put down. The costumes must be absolutely of the period. The organization that took care was indeed a superb one. It had its difficulties, contrast, and even some vociferous antagonism, naturally, at times. But finally, when things were smoothed out, the show went on, and what a show it was. But how did they manage? One instantly demands. The system was simple. This is interesting, I think. And to the surprise of all of us, it was much more democratic than today's boards, foundations, NGOs, and whatnot. I tell you how democratic it was. So there were two entities for the organization of the opera, sometimes complacent, not too often, when no problems cropped up, very rare. Many times at loggerheads at each other. But, as I said, the final outcome was usually a topmost production. There was, first of all, the contractual side, known as the Impresa, not the contractor. This was a group, a sort of company, under the able and knowledgeable leadership of an impresario. Now, the impresario, most of them were not only music lovers, not only knew a lot about music, they were directors of orchestra and even composers. So there you have the perfect membership, as well, of course, as a businessman. Now, the impresario, the main asset, however, of the impresario, what has it to be, was an unbounded love for opera, an organizational expertise, and more often than not, a sound musical background. Of course, to set up such an undertaking, one needed financial backing, and that's why many of these impresarios were well off financially, such as industrialists and so on. I need not and cannot, for lack of time, go into details of the contractual obligations that every impresa was subjected to. They were indeed of great exigence. I have seen one myself as regards the conditions. But, as if this was not enough, there was another commission. La Commissione. What was this commission? Absolute, another independent body, which was a sort, today we call it as an auditor, an auditor. But it had overriding powers. What was it? How was it made up of? This was made up of only four members, totally separated and independent of the Impresa, that controlled the plans and eventual staging of all the seasonal productions. This consisted of four members of sound musical and or operatic know-how that were appointed thus. One person by the government, another person by the Impresa itself, and two elected by the abbonati, by those who were paid, of course, for the whole season. That is, members, of course, lovers of the opera house, who usually booked for the whole season. This commission had almost overriding powers, and there were occasions when the Impresa had to bow down to their, one might call it, diktat. In this manner, one can easily surmise there was complete and reciprocal control that eventually resulted many times in super productions that added to the glories of this opera house. It is unfortunate that most, if not all, of these impresarios are nowadays forgotten. As I mentioned before, some of them were indeed a legend, such names as the famous Wolfgang Malfigiani, who was a composer himself, and that great director of orchestra, Domenico Amore, the composer as well, did a wonderful job. And they were also orchestra conductors of renown. The famous Zimelli, famous family of Golscher, the well-known composer Antonio Nani, apart from his musical knowledge, he also was a great impresario. Michelangelo Borch, famous, maybe Filippo Arpa, famous Lancellotti. Those of you perhaps remember in Valletta there was a shop of Lancellotti. The Side family, the Walter Macchini, who it is said organized and brought to fruition the most wonderful, successful operatic season of all, that of 1932-1935. We cannot, of course, leave out the impress of the well-known Giuseppe Farrugia, or the father of poor Nini, who left us not long ago, the close relative, recently bereaved, much lamented Nini Michele Farrugia, who almost single-handedly kept alive the torch that all people of these islands do not want to extinguish, the call for Valletta's Royal Opera House to be built dovera com'era. By now I suspect that many of you might be a bit vexed and want to put up the question, but what about the glories of the various wonderful performances themselves? As I said before, these are a legion, and it needs much more than one lecture, even just to mention them. But a brief overview now would not be amiss. I mentioned earlier the magical evening of the opening night of 1866, but there were other equally magical evenings through the lifespan of this Real Teatro for 70 years. As Giuseppe Gallia and others, that is like the wonderful, I don't have it now, book of Alfred Micheli, L'Historia dell'Opera of Malta, volume 2, relate, such magical evenings at the Royal Opera House were numerous, but some indeed eclipsed others. Following the success of the opening night, one can imagine how gleefully the impresa rubbed their hands, not only because of financial success, but also, if not more, because of the stage success. A famous Russian director of orchestra, Piotr, I think it is, Piotr or Pet, something that once said, a good conductor does not look at the success of his performance, but how well he defended the score of the composer. So this is another point to keep in mind. As a matter of fact, during that season, the first season alone, I Puritani, which is not by any means a light opera, was incredibly repeated 18 times during that season, as I said. And one has to keep in mind, as I mentioned earlier, that 167 operas were staged in that same season only in the Royal Opera House here. As an example of the success and high standard of opera performances, I can just mention one occurrence, that of 28 March 1867. In the same season, but later on in March, when Prince Alfred, Duke of Edinburgh, attended for an opera performed at this theatre. He was so pleased that he absolutely did not want to leave, and he wanted to go again at the next opera, which he did also the following Wednesday, 3rd April 1867. 3 years later, 1869, the Malfigiani organized one of the most glorious opera seasons, opening with the grand opera Gli Ugonotti by Giacomo Meyerbeer. It was such a huge success, and this is also a grand opera, it was such a huge success that the impresa was forced to repeat it several times in spite of its great difficulties, technical, orchestral, and choir, to stage it. Undaunted by such an undertaking, the same impresa presented another grand opera, famous William Tell of Rossini, to a wonderful, appreciative audience And it had to be repeated 22 times. We come now to the tragic mishap of the great fire that gutted the theater internally. To give you an idea of the gravity of this incident, I can only tell you that on discussing the tragic outcome of this burning, historians and architects told me, when they studied what exactly happened and saw, of course the records show, they told me that according to what was related and through records, especially of the extant damage suffered by the theater, this destruction of the burning of the Opera House in 18, of course, as you know, 73, this was of a much more serious difficulty than that suffered by the same theater in April 1942. In spite of this, what a lesson for us. Its rebuilding and restoration took only 4 years. And 7 years. It was reopened in October 1877 to the delight of all the Maltese population, as well as tourists, with a grandiose presentation of Verdi's Aida, for which a special corps de ballet was brought over from Italy. I am mentioning tourists. Perhaps you don't really done, because we are accustomed today to tourists, but many ships came with tourists simply and purely for opera. Sometimes so many tourists came to see opera that the theater could not hold them all. A year later, a memorable presentation of Bellini's Norma took place, and the people literally took the theater by storm. Again, as all tourists who were in the Grand Harbor and all the crew of a pleasure ship on hearing of the renown of our teatro, by the way, the teatro, our Royal Theater, Royal Opera House, this is not believed, but it was recognized and reckoned. It was declared in importance in Europe. First La Scala, secondly Garnier's Opera Paris, third of Malta, as regards the importance and especially of budding youngsters, where they are today. In fact, it is known that La Scala, when there were all these hundreds of budding youngsters, tenors, sopranos that were learning their voices, they used to tell them, go to Malta, se passate, if you pass the test of the Maltese critics, La Scala is open for you. Perhaps it's an exaggeration. No, this is true. La Scala used to tell the budding stars, go to Malta, because criticism here, the critics were so sharp, they were so strong, and they were held in such high esteem that if any singer passed the test of Malta, hundreds of them did not pass the test, La Scala was open for it. It was enough for the La Scala. As the Maltese went to La Scala to bring the best singers, at the other end, La Scala heard about the Maltese Royal Opera House, and there was this reciprocal agreement. And at the time, not like today, just 2 hours with an aeroplane go, they used to go there, these impresarios stay for months, choosing the best and bringing them over. Nothing but the best had to come out for this opera. So you can imagine how important it was. If it was considered the third, sometimes we do not believe these things, but many times, it's also my character, we in Malta, we belittle too much ourselves and praise too much foreigners. Well, and this, they took the theater by storm, as all tourists and crew of a pleasure ship of the P&O, Serapis, invaded the theater as well. It's not only that the theater was on the point of bursting, as it seems, but the most important point is that the opera itself had reached very high standards as regards singing, acting, costumes, and stage scenography. And here, you see, the also the baptism of the great, today unfortunately is not so well known, of the great painter Vincenzo Cremona. I think he's a relative of Amfin Cremona. Vincenzo Cremona, unfortunately, all his paintings were burnt when the great fire topped up. As well, another point on mentioning these painters, there was a special, not just praise and mentioning in papers, the painter used to call him out, and he must join also the clapping and the today you clap once or twice or no, they used to call the painter and have a special ovation for him. They even organized Serate di Beneficenza, which means found a painter who was paid very few pence at the time or shilling to Danau to go and in summer to receive his dues. It's okay to relate, albeit chronologically, the long list of successes, but as we have to follow the glories of this theatre, one has to think of those special occasions, and there were several of them, were added to the high standard productions. Occasionally, the impresa topped up the luscious cake, interesting this, with the proverbial cherry or even cherries. Now, I'm going to mention one case, because time is pressing. Now, imagine, for example, the fantastic night of 31st October 1879, when a brilliant Faust was sung and enacted, and singers from the most renowned theatres of Europe. And word was spreading out that there was another, because they used to make the impresa some surprises. Now what happened? The people were thrilled, although most of them were accustomed to high-caliber productions. With that evening's execution, to add more interest, word was spread around that on that evening something extra was to happen. So, in all expectancy, they waited until perhaps the most famous scene of the opera, the blaring forth of the famous soldiers' march, arrived. The maestro stopped the orchestra, and in came, fully dressed in period costume on stage, the whole Philharmonica La Valette, playing the famous march. Imagine the scene that gripped the whole audience, who through cries and shouts of bravi and bis, nobody could stop them, and brought really the house down. Another, just a little done, when Refice came and made Cecilia, it was again a huge success. But the impresa decided to say, no, the opera ends with St. Cecilia being lifted up in the sky on clouds. Eh? Now, to add that extra, then Monsignor Refice accepted also to drink this up. So, when St. Cecilia was rising up, and imagine a packed theater, seeing St. Cecilia rising up to heaven, it was the culmine, the apex of this room, and came in slowly and moving on a cloud, St. Paul himself. So the when the Maltese said St. Paul, the theater exploded. St. Paul for the Maltese, so, and especially the Paolini of Valletta. Not long after, just 3 months later, I am soon finishing, another glorifying moment for the theater occurred when Antonio Nani, this is another great event, famous opera, I Cavalieri di Malta was staged. A special troupe, for this opera, they brought over from it a special troupe from the great theaters of Napoli, Roma, and even from Milan for this first presentation. And it was such a huge success that it had to be repeated in just one season, 9 times in the same theater. Antonio Nani felt happily, I would say, so tired after that every time that this opera was presented, the smallest number that he made to make curtain calls was 13. In the same year, this theater offered to present the first performance of an opera by Giulio Cottrau. Interesting. Who was Giulio Cottrau? It was presented first in Malta's opera. He was a famous composer, Neapolitan one. Can you read what is this song? Most matter, you know it all over there. Who was the composer of this? He came to Malta and he directed his own opera. Imagine the huge success that he had. None other than the famous, world-famous Neapolitan melody, Vieni sul mar. And to top it all, of course, the composer himself was brought over to conduct it. Not to conduct it, he wanted to do also the rehearsals before. Although we are dealing exclusively with our Teatro Real, I have to mention one point that shows the craze for opera at the time. Of course, I did not mention the manual theater, but I have another point is to keep in mind, but I have to insert it in this context, simply because it did not peter out because of our opera house. There were two impresas, and there was great competition between Manuel and La. In fact, some of the prima donnas that had huge success in the Manuel, they used to spread carpets along Santa Lucia Street so that the prima donna would pass on them. And many, especially La, who really was a beautiful one, used to take off, like the way Francis Drake did to Queen Elizabeth. Yes, Sir Walter Raleigh, as Francis Drake. Francis Drake, and now he was playing with the Sir Walter Raleigh. Well, what's in a name? It had its impresa as well, and it carried on with opera productions, just the same, many of which were huge successes. On one occasion, for example, the son of the King of Sweden, Prince Oscar, was so pleased with Il Barbiere di Siviglia, the Manuel, that he immediately booked and attended for the opera Ballo in Maschera for the following day, but at the Royal Theatre. And I cannot forgo here the fact that this, and this is another incredibly true thing, there were other, of course, smaller theatres. This is another point, please keep it in mind. There were other smaller theatres who held opera, who stage operas. Leaders were Floriana, there were four theatres in Floriana, and also four in Slima. During this memorable season, 1880-1881, Valletta saw and heard, of course, no less this season. This is more, this theatre saw 176 operas. Yeah? If you count the days, there were at least, some of them were two, because there was the matinee as well. Eh? What am I to do? I am still at the year of our Lord, 1881. There is so much more to relate. Still more 50 years of glorious undertakings. Time flies as it flew over the honest, deeply cultural and wonderful entertainment that opera offered to our forefathers. But I am still halfway through. Well, thanks to Antonella, my wife, who, when she saw me perplexed and worried about the other remaining half of this wonderful, glorious Valletta's Royal Opera House, she simply said, "Why don't you think and prepare for a second lecture in sequence?" And that's what I'm going to do. But before you leave, I wish that you take with you the famous words of Verdi's Nabucco, "Va pensiero sulla liderata." Go, dear thought on golden wings, and relate how lovely was the land of our fathers. And that will surely bring about beautiful and happy dreams of what once was the glory of our Royal Opera House.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled "The Glories of Valletta's Royal Opera House." This talk was delivered by Mr. Salvatore Mosu.